Imagine walking into a modern hospital,
Sure.
right? And the doctor casually tells you they're going to perform an irreversible surgery on your body.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that sounds like a nightmare.
Right. And when you ask why, they don't, cite a disease. They don't point to a life-threatening condition at all. They simply say, well, it's a deeply held cultural tradition, so we're just going to bypass your consent.
I mean, in modern medicine, that sounds like a massive lawsuit just waiting to happen.
Exactly. You'd expect the ethical guardrails of the hospital to immediately kick in and stop it. But today, we're looking at a 700-page rule book that literally governs global health care.
Right.
And we're investigating a massive, religiously motivated blind spot where those very rules just suddenly vanish.
It's really the tension between what we claim is a universal rule and what we are willing to just ignore because it feels culturally familiar. And observing that tension play out at the absolute highest levels of academic philosophy is incredibly revealing.
Which is exactly why we're diving into a really sharp, highly analytical blog post today. We're very much agreeing with the critique laid out by the atheist and humanist Clemens Lenschinger.
Yes, his review was fantastic.
It really is. It's a highly factual, grounded conversation, honestly perfect for atheists and ethicists who want to dig into the logic of this stuff. Because Lenschinger took it upon himself to review what is widely considered the holy grail of medical ethics.
The book is called Principien der Bioethik, or in English, Principles of Biomedical Ethics.
Right. Written by Tom L. Beauchamp and James F. Childress.
And for ethicists, humanists, and frankly, anyone who cares about how medical power is wielded over you, this is an essential text. Beauchamp and Childress didn't just, write a book. They essentially built the architectural blueprint for modern medical morality.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because our mission for this deep dive is to first understand the mechanics of that blueprint. We need to break down the four universal principles of bioethics that these authors establish.
Right, the ones dictating how your doctor treats you right now.
Exactly. But then, using Lenschinger's brilliant critique as our lens, we're going to look at what happens when the architects of those rules seemingly forget to apply them to an ancient religious tradition.
To fully grasp the weight of Lenschinger's review, we really have to start by establishing the sheer gravity of the book he's critiquing.
Yeah, Principien der Bioethik is a true behemoth.
It really is. It was originally published in English way back in 1977.
Wow, so quite a while ago.
Yeah, and to put that into perspective, in the late 70s, bioethics as a formal, rigorous discipline was basically in its infancy.
Right.
It was sort of the Wild West of medical decision-making.
Because technology was advancing so rapidly, right? Like we had new life support machines, new transplant capabilities.
Exactly.
But the philosophy of how to use them ethically was lagging way, way behind.
Doctors were facing unprecedented moral dilemmas, and Beauchamp and Childress stepped right into that void. They did pioneering work that has shaped the global debate for nearly half a century now.
And the text has evolved right alongside modern medicine.
Yeah, growing thicker and more complex with every single edition.
And it is physically massive. We're looking at a text that is 713 pages long.
A literal heavyweight.
Right. And for this deep dive, we are referencing the 2024 German edition. And before we get into the heavy philosophy, we really have to acknowledge the translation work done here by Julia Pelger.
Oh, absolutely.
Lenschinger makes a specific point of praising her in his review, and it's easy to see why.
Because translating a philosophical text of this magnitude from American English into German is a monumental, incredibly high-stakes task.
Because it's not just about swapping out vocabulary words, right?
Yeah.
You aren't just translating like apple to apple.
Not at all. You are translating fundamental worldviews.
Yeah.
For instance, when the American authors discuss utility or duty, they're pulling from deeply ingrained Anglo-American interpretations of thinkers like John Stuart Mill.
Right, his utilitarianism.
Exactly, or Immanuel Kant's categorical imperative. And the German language has its own profound, highly specific philosophical vocabulary for these concepts.
So if a translator gets it wrong.
If she uses the wrong subtle inflection for a word like consent or harm, it could literally shift the legal and ethical meaning of the whole text.
Oh, wow.
But Pelger managed to capture the exact spirit and rigor of the original American framework without losing those critical nuances.
That's incredible. But, hearing all this philosophical history, Kantian duty, 700 pages, academic translation, I got to ask on behalf of everyone listening,
Sure.
is this just an academic doorstop? Like, is this something only medical students and moral philosophers are forced to read in a dusty library? Or does this actually dictate what happens to me when I walk into an ER?
Oh, it absolutely dictates your experience. It is the invisible framework holding up the entire medical system.
Really?
Yeah, and what makes this book so universally revered is that it's far from a dry, abstract textbook. It's structured around gripping, real-world case studies.
So they aren't just talking about abstract trolley problems on a black book.
No, no. They're talking about the ICU. They dive deep into pandemic response.
Oh, very relevant.
Right. Like, if a hospital is overwhelmed, who gets the ventilator? They analyze vaccine equity, who gets a life-saving shot first when supplies are incredibly limited.
So they're dealing with really messy stuff.
Exactly. They tackle the ethics of genome editing, data protection, and even the moral status of automated decisions and artificial intelligence in healthcare.
Okay, so if the book tackles everything from pandemics to AI algorithms, we need to understand the engine driving those decisions.
Yeah.
Like, how do they actually resolve these intense high-stakes dilemmas? And that brings us to the author's core framework known as Four Principle Ethics.
The genius of this framework is its structural simplicity, though applying it is, well, wonderfully complex. The authors lay out four fundamental principles.
Okay.
But the crucial thing to understand, and this is where the friction happens later on, is that these principles are non-hierarchical.
Meaning there isn't one ultimate trump card. Like, principle one doesn't automatically beat principle three.
Right. In any given medical dilemma, these four rules have to be weighed against each other on a case-by-case basis. They are constantly in tension.
Let's see how that tension works. The first principle is the respect for autonomy.
Yes.
This is all about the right to informed consent and self-determination. It means you, as the patient, have to be given all the information, you have to actually understand it, and your final decision regarding your own body must be respected.
And, you know, here's where it gets really interesting. We shouldn't gloss over how revolutionary that was.
Right, because medicine wasn't always like that.
Exactly. Before frameworks like this took hold, medicine was largely defined by medical paternalism.
The doctor knows best.
Yeah, that was the prevailing attitude for centuries. The physician, as the educated expert, made the decisions for the patient's own good, often without even explaining the risks.
But autonomy shattered that dynamic. It gave you the right to look at a brilliant surgeon and say, I understand your advice. I know this treatment could save my life, but I am refusing it.
Right. Then we introduced the second principle, non-maleficence.
Which is the classic do no harm, right?
Exactly. It's the strict obligation of the medical professional to avoid inflicting injury, to minimize potential risks, and to prevent unnecessary suffering.
And then principle number three is beneficence, which, I mean, it sounds similar, but represents the proactive side of the coin.
Yeah, it's not just about avoiding harm. It's about actively promoting well-being. It requires doctors to carefully evaluate the actual tangible benefit of an intervention, and it mandates the active protection of vulnerable groups.
And finally, principle number four, justice.
Right, which broadens the lens from the individual patient to society as a whole.
So it's about the fair and equitable distribution of healthcare resources.
Exactly. Are we providing equal access to care? Are we allocating scarce resources in a way that's morally justifiable?
Okay, so let's put these principles into a scenario to see how they clash. Because if I come into the hospital bleeding and I refuse a life-saving blood transfusion based on, say, my personal beliefs.
Right, your autonomy is telling the doctor to step away.
Yes, but the doctor's principle of beneficence, their mandate to save my life, is screaming at them to give me the blood. Which principle
yeah.
wins?
And that is exactly why this book is 700 pages long. Beauchamp and Childress spend hundreds of pages meticulously navigating these exact collisions.
Wow.
They provide a rigorous methodology for how a physician should weigh your autonomy against their beneficence.
I mean, they apply that same rigorous math to everything. Like, if an AI algorithm is diagnosing skin cancer, how does that impact the principle of justice?
Exactly. Are the data sets biased against certain skin tones? They agonize over these details.
So it's very thorough.
Very. And what's fascinating here is how the authors frame this entire four-principle system. They don't present it as just a useful tool for Western hospitals.
Oh, really?
No, they argue that these principles represent a common morality.
A universal moral baseline.
Yes. They make the bold philosophical claim that while specific cultural practices might vary, the underlying moral imperative of autonomy, non-maleficence, beneficence, and justice transcends borders, cultures, and religions.
That's a huge claim.
It is. They argue this is the bedrock of how human beings universally understand ethical behavior.
Okay, so if the book's own rules are supposed to be a universal, culture-spanning common morality, we have to figure out how two world-renowned ethicists managed to completely ignore a massive violation of those rules.
Yeah.
And to do that, we pivot to Clemens Lenschinger's humanist critique.
And this is where Lenschinger's review becomes a really incisive piece of philosophical detective work. He identifies a glaring contradiction.
Yeah, Lenschinger points out that despite all this rigor, despite the hundreds of pages of ethical agonizing over AI and pandemics, the authors give a complete free pass to a very specific religious tradition.
That total free pass.
Over 40 years of rescissions, tracking the evolution of modern medicine across multiple editions. There was absolutely no dedicated chapter, no prominent problematization whatsoever of the circumcision of male infants.
It is a profound silence.
Truly.
And what makes Lenschinger's critique so structurally sharp is that he doesn't use outside ideology to attack the book.
Right. He's not bringing in some other framework.
No. He simply picks up the author's own philosophical tools, applies them to this real-world medical practice, and shows how the entire framework breaks down.
Well, let's do exactly that. Let's run this practice through your machine. Starting with principle one, autonomy.
Okay.
How does irreversible infant surgery hold up against the principle of self-determination and informed consent?
It fails spectacularly. By definition, an infant is a blank slate in terms of consent. They lack the cognitive capacity to understand, let alone agree to, the procedure.
Of course.
Lenschinger highlights the ethical reality here. Parents are essentially using the child's body as a canvas to exercise their own personal religious freedom.
And the doctors.
The medical professionals performing the procedure, they are actively bypassing the child's future self-determination by making a permanent alteration before the child even has a voice.
Think about the cosmetic surgery analogy. Like if a fully grown, consenting adult walks into a clinic and says, I want a surgery to permanently alter my physical appearance.
Right.
The doctor goes through a rigorous process of informed consent. They discuss the risks, the alternatives, and they ensure the adult is making a free choice.
Yeah, that's the principle of autonomy working perfectly.
Exactly. But when you take an infant who has no religious affiliation of their own yet and no ability to say no, and you impose a permanent surgery on them for cultural reasons, you have entirely discarded autonomy.
Completely. If a medical professional were to strictly apply Beauchamp and Childress's first principle, the logical conclusion is undeniable.
What would they have to say?
They would have to say, we must wait until this individual is old enough to provide informed consent for a non-life-saving, irreversible alteration to their own body.
But wait, let me push back here, because I can hear the counter-argument forming.
Sure, go for it.
Wouldn't defenders of the practice point to medical arguments? Like, I've heard people talk about lower infection rates or hygienic benefits. How does Lenschinger's critique, using the author's own rules, address the medical arguments in favor of it?
That is exactly where the principles of non-maleficence and beneficence are supposed to do the heavy lifting.
Right. Remember, non-maleficence is do no harm and minimize risk.
And beneficence is actively promoting well-being and protecting the vulnerable.
So how does it fail those tests?
Because the threshold for performing an irreversible surgery on a non-consenting patient is incredibly high. You're introducing inherent surgical risks, bleeding, infection, surgical error.
Yeah, all surgeries have risks.
Exactly. And you're causing permanent physical changes by removing healthy, functional tissue. To justify that under the author's own rules, there must be an immediate, compelling medical necessity.
You have to be curing a disease or saving a life right now.
Exactly. Preventative hygiene or a statistically minor reduction in future, easily treatable infections, simply does not meet the book's own stated threshold for bypassing a patient's autonomy and inflicting a permanent physical alteration.
Because you aren't treating a sick child.
No, you are surgically altering a healthy one.
So, according to the principle of non-maleficence, minimizing risks and avoiding unnecessary harm, and the principle of beneficence, protecting the vulnerable from non-essential interventions, the practice is ethically indefensible under the book's own stated rules.
Lenschinger is proving that the math simply does not add up.
Yeah.
I mean, the authors rigorously dissect the ethics of whether a hospital can mandate a vaccine during a lethal pandemic, but they completely ignore the ethics of surgically altering a healthy infant's genitals for religious or cultural reasons.
Yeah, so if Lenschinger's can use their own framework to dismantle this practice so clearly, How do Beauchamp and Childress miss it over 40 years and multiple editions?
It's a great question.
Because they aren't sloppy thinkers. These are brilliant, meticulous philosophers.
No, they are brilliant, which means that the omission isn't an accident of intellect. We have to look at their environment. We have to look at the cultural water they were swimming in when they wrote and revised this book.
Yeah, and Lynn Shinger offers a very compelling theory here. The authors are American.
Right.
And in the North American cultural context, particularly over the last century, infant circumcision hasn't just been viewed as a specialized religious ritual. It was heavily medicalized and normalized across the broader population, far beyond its religious origins.
It just became the default setting.
Right.
And the history of how it became so normalized in the U.S. is genuinely fascinating and honestly a bit disturbing.
Oh, totally.
The source material highlights that back in the 19th century in the United States, some doctors actually started promoting circumcision to the general public with the unscientific belief that it would prevent undesirable sexual behaviors.
Yes, specifically, they believed it would deter masturbation. At the time, various medical authorities bizarrely viewed masturbation as the root cause of countless physical and mental ailments, from epilepsy to blindness.
It sounds like medieval pseudoscience to us now.
It really does.
But in the 19th century U.S., these doctors were using the formidable authority of medicine to justify and spread a cultural, moralistic practice. They dressed a moral panic in a white lab coat. Wow. And over decades, long after the anti-masturbation theories were debunked, the surgical practice just remained. It became baked into standard hospital routine.
Millions of families who didn't even have a religious connection to the practice just accepted it because that's what the doctor does.
Exactly. And this raises an important question about the limits of philosophy. If Beauchamp and Childress are claiming to have discovered a universal common morality,
a set of ethical rules that applies to all human beings everywhere.
Right. How can they allow their own specific localized cultural bias to create such a massive blind spot?
That is the ultimate frustration Lynn Shinger expresses. And it exposes a glaring double standard. Because let's be clear here. Even if you are a listener who views circumcision as a highly complex moral gray area.
Sure.
Maybe you see it as an incredibly difficult balancing act between a parent's right to cultural tradition and the individual infant's right to physical autonomy.
Even if you view it as the ultimate ethical knot, a 700-page encyclopedia of medical ethics must attempt to untie it.
Right. It is the omission that is so damning.
The authors will split philosophical hairs over the nuances of data privacy. They'll dedicate pages and pages to the abstract moral status of artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
But when it comes to an irreversible physical surgery performed on millions of non-consenting infants, the dilemma isn't even placed on the table for debate.
It's as if they walked right up to the edge of this deeply sensitive religious and cultural issue, looked down at their own rigorous ethical rules, and just decided to look the other way.
It feels like a capitulation.
It does. It feels like, in this specific instance, universal morality was asked to quietly step aside in the hallway so as not to offend tradition.
And this is precisely why Lynn Shinger's review is such a vital companion piece for anyone, whether you're an atheist, an ethicist, or a medical professional reading this book.
Right.
Principium der Bioethik remains an undeniable masterpiece. It gives us the vital vocabulary to fight for patient rights and navigate the future of medicine. But Lynn Shinger reminds us that we cannot turn off our critical thinking just because a textbook is considered a classic.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? It's that illusion of structural engineering again.
Mm.
We want the rules of medical ethics to be a perfectly load-bearing bridge.
We really do.
We want to believe that when we walk into a hospital, the ethical guidelines supporting our care are mathematically precise and universally applied.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the reality is that human bias introduces hidden stress fractures. No matter how rigorous or seemingly objective an ethical framework appears to be on paper, the cultural comfort zones of the humans writing those rules will always seep in.
True ethics requires us to constantly evaluate if certain traditions are being granted a silent, unearned immunity.
Exactly.
I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over long after this deep dive ends. We've just seen how two brilliant pioneers of bioethics managed to write a 700-page foundational text while harboring a massive, culturally induced blind spot.
Yeah.
So as we stand right now on the precipice of a totally new era of medicine, as ethicists sit down today to write the universal rules for artificial intelligence, CRISPR gene editing, and neural brain implants, what unexamined cultural norms of our current generation are secretly shaping those new guidelines?
It's a slightly terrifying thought.
What glaring ethical contradictions are we quietly ignoring today simply because they feel normal to us right now?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the framework, and we will catch you next time.